dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And
as we you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Venner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, KSOW Cottage Grove, or WMRW Warren. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. As longtime listeners to this program are aware, we've been covering the movement to get to the truth about the perpetrators of the events of 9/11 and the extent to which elements inside the U.S. government may have been involved. To even inquire into this has for many years been a no-go zone for journalists who desire to maintain, quote, credibility, and it is still a no-go zone in most respects. Though a growing number of mainstream figures in the press and in politics are revealing and discussing the various administration lies and deceptions related to the invasion of Iraq that skirt quite close to the issue, given that 9/11 has provided the justification for the endless war on terrorism and all that has been done in its name. Among the works receiving mainstream attention recently are investigative journalist Ron Suskind's new book, The Way of the World, as well as former Los Angeles prosecutor and best-selling author Vincent Bugliosi's book, The Prosecution of George W. Bush for Murder. He testified before the House Judiciary Committee late last month. Professor David Ray Griffin's book, 9/11 Contradictions, An Open Letter to Congress and the Press, is getting attention thus far from neither Congress nor the mainstream press. But you're going to hear a presentation he made along with Professor Michelle Chisadovsky in Montreal in June discussing his fifth book, challenging the official story of 9/11. I'd like to set the stage with a few clips drawn from recent press interviews and congressional testimony. First, an excerpt of an August 6th interview with Ron Suskind on C-SPAN's Washington Journal program.
Joining us now, author Ron Suskind in his new book, The Way of the World, A Story of Truth and Hope in an Age of Extremism. Let's start off with an item that was in the Washington Post this morning. White House denies author's accusations of document forgery. Tell us about that and why they're making those accusations.
Well, the White House is, we expected the White House would deny this. I mean, essentially they have almost no choice. If they say we did this, then they have to start their own investigation and start firing people. Interestingly, you know, we've had a fascinating 24-hour cycle. The book, of course, is about the conflict between power and morality. Here you've got power sort of having its day, it seems. Two of the sources have been on the phone with me. One of them, a guy, Rob Richer, who is one of the sources, a senior CIA guy, was fine with the book and when he chatted with me and other reporters in the morning yesterday and into the early afternoon. But who knows, something happened yesterday, late afternoon. He got some calls, hard to say. He kind of sent out a statement and vanished. The other fellow, John McGuire, who's one of the other sources, both of them are guys who are taped, obviously, extensively, hour after hour, going through their recollections of this particular area, having to do with a letter, the Habush letter, so-called, the letter the White House is actually most agitated about, because if they have to answer to that, it's the kind of thing that could well be an impeachment hearing rather soon. It's illegal to do what the book shows quite clearly. the White House did in terms of evidence, in terms of that letter. Interestingly, the other fellow, John McGuire, I've emailed back and forth with last night and early this morning, and he had the book misrepresented to him. Basically, he doesn't have a copy yet. He's way out there in the region, Iraq, Kurdistan, and so he's going to get a copy of the book today. He finally gets to read it. You know, it's tough. You have sympathy for this guy here. The global news cycles are burning up. His name is in it. Everyone's read the book, or lots of people. He hasn't read it yet. And you know, he's like, please just get me a copy. Because what he sent to me as to say, I thought I said this, and I said, that's exactly what you said. That's what's in the book. He said, well, people are saying I said other things. So he seems to have been misled a bit. It's an active situation where you've got, of the many sources, more than 100 sources in the book, you've got two particular sources who especially are finding that their statements might be at the core of an impeachment hearing. It's a rather unique situation. And one of them has felt great pressure as of yesterday afternoon, and the other one is just now reading the book.
Remind us who Habush is and the significance of the letter that you're talking about.
Yeah, Habush is the Iraqi intelligence chief. Here's the way the story unfolds. In early 2003, we set up a kind of joint U.S.-British mission to meet Habush. Habush was secreted out of Baghdad to Amman, Jordan. That's where the safe house was. And in a mission, U.S.-UK mission, headed up by a U.K. guy, head of their Mideast division, who met with Habush in Amman, he started to inform us, to give us information about a back channel. This back channel told the United States and Britain that there was no WMD. Now, Habush is a source. Habush is, though, a special source. He is the chief of Iraqi intelligence. He's their top man. And so he went through an amazing kind of dance with us in this very contentious period before the war. What's fascinating is that what Habush's report shows is that he said there was no WMD, biological, chemical, nuclear. He has oversight over the biological program himself as the head of the intelligence service. And also he gave us a very clear rendering, as I show in the book, from people involved in this, testifying on the record, on tape, that Saddam didn't believe we were going to invade. He was quite confused about U.S. intentions, all but saying, why would they want this country? I thought they didn't. I thought it was Islamic radicalism they were interested in. That's not really here. And he was most concerned about Iran. Fearful as he was of their nuclear program, he was afraid Iran would find out that he's a toothless tiger. That was driving Saddam's odd behavior in these months leading up to the war. This intelligence, this report, created havoc, certainly inside of the U.S. government, in many parts at the upper reaches. That's reported in the book. Ultimately, the channel to Habush is cut off. Lots of folks say it's because he was telling us something we didn't want to hear that undercut our case for WMD, the case for war. Then he was relocated, part of a deal we set up with him. He was resettled in Amman, Jordan. We paid him $5 million. And a lot of people involved in this say, well, I'm not sure what you'd call that other than maybe hush money, because we didn't really use him for anything. We settled him there. There was fear during the summer of 2003, as all of the evidence came out clear to the world, something people suspected beforehand, that there may not be WMD in Iraq. Of course, we found there weren't. That's the summer Joe Wilson and Valerie Plame stepped up as well. And at that point, we decide, based on our deal with Habush, that we will pay him $5 million. Now, to get to the fall of 2003, and then that's the specific area that the White House is, they're concerned about much in the book, but that's one area of greatest concern for them, certainly, and the most vituperative attacks, is that in the fall of 2003, the White House, ignoring Habush, he's the last man they want to see at this point, the guy who told us ahead of time what everyone finds out later, they decide they have a use for Habush, and that is that he will be part of a mission the White House orders the CIA to do. Again, many sources in the book talk about this in great detail on the record, to fabricate a letter, ostensibly a handwritten letter from Habush to Saddam Hussein, backdated July 1st, 2001, saying that Mohammed Atta trained in Iraq prior to 9/11, establishing that link, which the White House was very anxious to establish. Of course, there is no real link. And also that Saddam was actively buying yellowcake uranium from Niger with the help of al-Qaeda. That's what the letter says. It's well known. It's called the Habush letter, because the whole idea is that it would pop up in the global news cycles, which it does in December of 2003, and it roils the news cycles here and abroad for that week. Tom Brokaw talks about it. William Sapphire writes a column. And that last part, Rob, this is the important finish to this Habush part of the book, is that violates the statutes that form the CIA, including an amendment in 1991 saying the CIA cannot run disinformation campaigns on the United States population. That's against the law. The evidence that I've gathered, the evidence in the book and the evidence which is on the record from tape testimonies, and that's why Congress is so interested now to get these people in front of committees under oath, shows that the White House ordered the CIA to do this thing, which was a bit out of character for CIA even, and that would be a violation of law. And that's why these two fellows, who I've got great sympathy for, I mean, they're under enormous pressure. Their words essentially stand in a kind of collision course with the White House, because their words bring about an impeachment proceeding.
Former CIA Director George Tenet issued a statement. We've got it from Politico.com. He says there were many Iraqi officials who said both publicly and privately that Iraq had no WMD, but our foreign intelligence colleagues and we assessed that these individuals were parroting the Ba'ath party line and trying to delay any coalition attack. The particular source that Susskind cites offered no evidence to back up his assertion and acted in an evasive and unconvincing manner. The second nugget involves a supposed order from the White House to me at CIA to have my staff fabricate a letter connecting Iraq with al-Qaeda and the attacks of 9/11. Susskind says that CIA was directed to get an Iraqi official to copy the bogus information in his own hand and then cause it to be leaked to the media. There was no such order from the White House to me, nor, to the best of my knowledge, was anyone from CIA ever involved in such an effort.
You know, it's hard to know what to make of George's statement, because the evidence that has been gathered, again, from testimony of people involved, contradicts that. And that's people here and abroad. And what's interesting about this particular controversy is that both ends of the Habush drama have been a best-kept secret for 5 years. Here's a man, the Iraqi intelligence chief, that we paid $5 million. The U.S. government paid him, hid him. He has been supposedly wanted. We've had him out on State Department sites, wanted, a most wanted war criminal, $1 million reward for his capture. He's the Jack of Diamonds in Bush's deck. And finally now it's coming out in this book, which is why, as I said, people in Congress are saying, thank you for this book, but certainly there's only so much you can do with people, even on the record. We have to get the hot lights up and get people under oath with threat of perjury testifying, from George Tenet, people in the White House on down. That's certainly the thinking at this point. And actually, this is an emblematic story, as Rob Richards says in the book, and John McGuire and others, Buzzy Krongard, the number three guy at CIA too. They talk about the controversy, and also in a general way, they talk about this being the core problem of this era. Richard talks about this, as I said, almost like everything else in the book. He has no problems except that one little part, at least thus far. The pressure he's under must be just acute. He's a contractor to the government. He says, others say, this is the core issue, how the political process has manipulated intelligence in this era and corrupted the intelligence function in ways that violate basic American standards.
Ron Susskind. 2 weeks earlier, on July 25th, New York Congressmember Maurice Hinchey testified in a similar vein to the House Judiciary Committee as part of an all-day hearing on executive power. Listen carefully to this excerpt of his remarks.
This administration has been dominated throughout by corruption and incompetence. And that needs to be addressed. We need to be sure that in the future we have a president who understands his obligations and responsibilities and who lives up to those obligations and responsibilities and who works responsibly with the other two branches of government. And I think with regard to the situation in Iraq and this terrorist operation, which has dominated so much of what this administration has done, the proper kind of attention has to be directed to this situation from the very beginning. And if you look at that situation from the very beginning, one of the things that you see is that 2 months before the election of November 2000, there was a meeting with the president and the intelligence operation, director of intelligence, to inform him about one of the major problems that we had to confront as a nation, which was the fact that Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda was determined to attack the United States. That was a message which was delivered down in Crawford, Texas, in September of 2000. Following that, there were more than 40 intelligence briefings delivered to the top levels of this administration from January 2001 through September 10th of 2001, including references, all of those briefings included references to Al-Qaeda, references to bin Laden, and the fact that they were determined to engage in various forms of attack. The most prominent one of those PDBs, for example, was the one that was made public, which was delivered on August 6th, which was so obvious, even particularly in its headline, about those facts. The warnings to the White House about Osama bin Laden were extended and consistent and should have promoted actions to prevent the attack of September 11th, but they did not. And why they did not is a major question that we need to be confronting, I believe, as a Congress, particularly here in the House of Representatives.
Congressman Maurice Hinchey. The 9/11 Truth Movement has, for many years now, been asking a similar question to Hinchey's. I played you that clip because of Hinchey's comment that he sort of breezes through, that George Bush, then the governor of Texas, was briefed of possible attacks 2 months before the so-called election of November 2000. Is it usual to give intelligence briefings to presidential candidates? Or were all governors similarly briefed? A question that requires looking into a bit further. Vincent Bugliosi's call to charge Bush and other administration officials with murder is based on the use of deliberate deception to initiate a war in Iraq, leading to the deaths of thousands of U.S. soldiers. He also testified before the House Judiciary Committee. Here he begins by responding to comments made by a previous witness.
Attorney Vincent Bugliosi.
Yes, sir. To summarize what I believe Mr. Presser said, he apparently feels that President Clinton having consensual sexual relations outside of marriage and lying about it is worse than the Bush administration taking this nation to war on a terrible lie, a war that has caused incalculable death, horror, and suffering. And I would ask Mr. Presser, what previously recognized form of logic would allow such a conclusion? I'd like to give you words from Mr. Bush's own mouth that I think are relevant to this proceeding. January 31st, 2003, less than 2 months before Bush ordered the invasion of Iraq, on the rationale that Hussein was an imminent threat to the security of this country, so we had to strike first in self-defense. Bush and British Prime Minister Tony Blair met in the Oval Office with six of their top aides, including Blair's chief foreign policy advisor, David Manning. After the meeting, Manning prepared a five-page memo stamped extremely sensitive, summarizing what was said at the meeting. He wrote that George Bush, not Blair now, George Bush was so worried about the failure of UN inspectors to find weapons of mass destruction in Iraq that he talked about three possible ways to, quote, provoke a confrontation, unquote, with Hussein, one of which was to, quote, this is quoting George Bush, quote, fly U-2 reconnaissance aircraft over Iraq, painted in United Nations colors, and if Hussein fired on them, Bush said, he would be in violation of UN resolutions, and this would justify our going to war. So Bush is telling the American people, telling the world, Congress that Hussein is an imminent threat to the security of this country, but behind closed doors, George Bush was talking about how to provoke Hussein into a war. Now, Chairman, may I draw an inference from this? Thank you. If George Bush honestly believed that Hussein was an imminent threat to the security of this country, which is the main reason he gave the American people for going to war, the thought of provoking Hussein into a war, by definition, would never, ever, ever have entered his mind. And I say this, that by taking this nation to war on a lie, all of the killings of American soldiers in Iraq became unlawful killings and therefore murder.
And what then of the 3,000 people killed on American soil on 9/11? Here is Professor Michel Chesedovsky, director of the Center for Research on Globalization at globalresearch.ca and a professor of economics at the University of Ottawa. He introduced David Ray Griffin at an event organized by Montreal 9/11 Truth, who kindly provided the audio to us.
Great pleasure in introducing our speaker tonight, David Ray Griffin, who, with tremendous modesty, a sense of justice and ethics, and a commitment to the truth, combined with painstaking research into all the various innuendos of this tragic event of 9/11, has now come up with a fourth book, which is addressed to the members of the U.S. Congress and the media. I think what is disturbing in our understanding of 9/11 is the extent to which both at the official level, namely politicians, governments, but also non-governmental organizations, as well as civil society organizations, anti-war movement, that one denies certain occurrences, one affirms certain occurrences, when in fact all the evidence points to the contrary. And the 9/11 narrative, as contained in the 9/11 Commission report, is a fabrication. It's a fabrication. There may be certain elements of truth in there, but when you look at the whole document, and when you look at the media interpretations, and you start to investigate, and then you start looking at Building 7, which is reported by the BBC and CNN 20 minutes before it actually occurs, and you see the reporter in front of the building saying, well, which implies that there was foreknowledge of that event. When you start to confront the issue of the narrative regarding what happened on the planes with the cell phone conversations from 31,000 feet, when everybody knows that you can't make a call above 8,000 feet, at least we've tried when we're on the aircrafts and so on and so forth. The lies are so extensive. I think that when we started up with this when we started up shortly after 9/11, we were extremely cautious in the statements we made. But now we can say that this is perhaps the biggest lie in U.S. history, and it's not a standalone lie. It's a lie which is the pillar of the national security doctrine. It's the pillar of the military agenda in the Middle East. Because every single action, political action, whether it's in strategic, military, foreign policy, domestic policy, national security, emergency procedures, always rests on the notion that we have to defend against this elusive outside enemy, Osama bin Laden, who in any event is a creation of the CIA, known and documented, okay? known and documented by Senate reports and by FBI reports and so on and so forth. So that the debunking of the lie is now something much more straightforward to what it was in the early, let's say late September of 2001. But I'd like to recall briefly what happened on that day. David Ray Griffin will elaborate on the whole process. But if you recall, already at 11 o'clock in the morning, they said, absolutely certain Bin Laden is behind it, Al-Qaeda, blah, blah, blah. Okay? The investigation hadn't even been conducted by the FBI, and the FBI to this day denies that in fact Osama had anything to do with it. The War Cabinet met in the afternoon, and in the evening the war on Afghanistan had been declared on the basis of retribution against those sponsors of the 9/11 attacks. And within a 24-hour period, NATO, invoking Article 5 of its constitution, which stipulates that an attack on one of its members is an attack on all of its members, then also declared war on Afghanistan. Now, in Canada, we've totally forgotten the rationale for Canadian involvement in Afghanistan. Okay, we discussed peacekeeping and rebuilding and so on. But ultimately, it's Article 5 of the NATO Constitution, which says, you know, we have to stand by the United States. But bear in mind that NATO took that decision even at the same time as the White House. They took it on almost on the same day. And then on the 7th of October, the war was initiated. Now, bear with me, I don't know how many months the 9/11 Truth movement in Montreal has been preparing this event, but the war in Afghanistan was prepared in 3 weeks. Believe it. No, a war takes at least a year to prepare, a large-scale theater operation, and the decision to go to war usually is a very complex decision, as we see unfolding events with regard to Iran. That war was already in those war plans were already in the pipeline well before 9/11. The declaration of war in the evening of 9/11 was there to trigger something which was already in the pipeline. So that and then we were led to believe that there wasn't a single analyst of military and strategic affairs, and there are numerous numbers of those who had the honesty to say, well, you know, you don't prepare war in 3 weeks. Okay, nobody prepares anything, not even a conference, in 3 weeks. So, but that's those are layers of lies, and we have to understand that because we are dealing with the global war on terrorism, with the right to intervene in countries invoking. And it's not only in the Middle East, it's in a whole series of countries where the United States is intervening, in Africa, in the Philippines, in Thailand, and so on, always under the pretext that they're going after Islamic terrorists, etc. When we know that, in fact, the CIA are the architects of Al-Qaeda, going back to the Soviet-Afghan war. So that... And then... we have statements emanating from the Pentagon, from Dick Cheney, and saying, I quote, that a second 9/11 would be both justification and an opportunity to go after known targets. I'm quoting a Pentagon document leaked to the Washington Post. So that these, and they repeated it on numerous occasions. Yes, we would like to have a second 9/11, etc. We recall Operation Northwoods, which was also a secret operation of the Pentagon to invade Cuba by planting bombs in Miami and creating, quote, a useful wave of indignation. So that when David Ray Griffin, in his first book on 9/11, raises the issue of a new Pearl Harbor. That rationale is part of the military agenda. It's interesting that General Tommy Franks, who led the invasion of Iraq, in an interview, I think it's 2003 interview, where he with Cigarro Aficionado, it's a gentleman's magazine, and he talks about, he uses the term mass casualty producing event. Mass casualty producing event. And he insinuates, and you can look up the quotes, he insinuates that a mass casualty producing event of the size and the nature of 9/11 might contribute to galvanizing public support for the militarization of civilian institutions, which means justice, law enforcement, and so on, so as to preserve democracy in America, etc., etc. So that this and this doesn't come from somebody, this comes from the hierarchy of the U.S. military. It's not a statement made by an individual. He's using concepts and slogans which are used behind closed doors, mass casualty producing event, and so on and so forth, opportunity, justification, etc. I say this because we are living perhaps the most serious economic and social crisis in modern history, where the United States and its indefectible British ally, but also NATO and Israel, are involved in a war without borders, extending the frontiers of U.S. influence around the world, but particularly in the Middle East. And in a very real sense, this military agenda, combined also with an economic agenda, with a police state, threatens the future of humanity, particularly when you state in military documents, and that's why the work of David Ray Griffin is so important. In military documents, they said we should go after Bin Laden with nuclear weapons, okay? And no, I'm not joking, because I read this kind of stuff, or a good case could be made. And then they say, well, of course, nuclear weapons are harmless to the surrounding civilian population, and they'd be redefined. Now, if we look at Canada-U.S. relations, the whole agenda of the SPP, of the North American Union, is also integrated into the war on terrorism, because we're protecting the continent against... So it's not only the United States... as Rumsfeld said, Northern Command extends from the Caribbean right up to the Canadian Arctic. And he made that statement in 2002. I wrote on it more or less at that time, in 2003, 2004, that this grants the United States the right to intervene militarily anywhere, on land, sea, of course, in the air, under NORAD, but send in troops into Canada, into Mexico, into countries of the Caribbean, under the terms of reference of Northern Command, and Northern Command has a mandate to fight Bin Laden. Okay, so that we must understand that 9/11 is very crucial, and because without 9/11, these guys are stuck. They don't have a justification for doing anything. In other words, if 9/11, the 9/11 truth movement integrated into an anti-war movement could lead ultimately to breaking the consensus which pervades our society, because the whole process, the whole justification for war, torture, police state, and so on would collapse like a deck of cards. And the criminals in high office would be revealed for what they are. And that is why, David Ray Griffin who is a distinguished author, theologian, professor of philosophy, religion, with more than 30 books, and he told me that when 9/11 happened, he dropped a lot of his other research to get into the way he tackles this is not by making accusations or making statements which are not backed by fact. It is by confronting the official's explanations, which are both presented by the U.S. administration and the commission and so on, and the media, and in an utterly factual and investigative mode, he manages to refute much of the official explanations that are presented to us on a day-to-day basis, and which serve to justify far-reaching decisions like going to war and killing people and torturing people. And of course, you don't know whether they're terrorists before you actually torture them, because, so that's the logic. They say we have to torture them because they're terrorists, but we don't know that they're terrorists, and so on. And so that the approach that David Ray Griffin has taken is through careful investigation to refute the official story and narrative and confront the media and the U.S. Congress. And that's what he's done in his last book. Without further ado, I would like to welcome him to Canada and Quebec and Canada. The city of Montreal and the Saint Saint Pierre, which has always respected freedom of speech and debate under the auspices of the Catholic Church. So we would like to welcome our speaker tonight, David Ray Griffin.
Thank you all for coming out. As he just pointed out, the effects of 9/11, that is, the effects of the belief in the official theory of 9/11, have been far-reaching. One of the many effects, beyond six or seven that he mentioned, is that we have, or at least have, this tradition that you are innocent until proven guilty. But now Muslims around the world feel that they are guilty until proven innocent. The topic I'm going to address tonight is, did Muslims attack the United States of America on 9/11? Because that is the basis for most of these things. Certainly the war in Afghanistan, the war in Iraq, and the war that we probably would have had in Iran already if the one in Iraq had gone a little better from the administration's point of view. Most of what I will talk about tonight will be from my latest book, which is called 9/11 Contradictions, an Open Letter to Congress and the Press. A few of the items will be from the previous book, which is called Debunking 9/11, Debunking an Answer to Popular Mechanics and Other Defenders of the Official Conspiracy Theory. So between those two, from those two come the material for tonight. But I've organized it in a different way here. And I will try to go quite quickly. I have another title for this would be 21 Reasons Why the Official Story is False. So I'm going to go through these pretty quickly just to give you an idea of what these reasons are, leaving you to, if you want to, read the books to get more detail. First of all, Osama bin Laden, do we have any evidence that he was really responsible for 9/11? Of course, the whole story is based on that assumption. But shortly after 9/11, Colin Powell, then the Secretary of State, promised to work up a paper in which he would give this proof. The very next day, in the Rose Garden meeting with President Bush, he had to withdraw that pledge and say, well, we do have all this evidence, but it's all classified, so I can't tell you now. I hope I can tell you in the future. Tony Blair thought that wasn't good enough, so he volunteered to write this document, and he did. And it had all this proof, except that on the very first page it said, this does not purport to provide evidence that would stand up in a court of law. So it was good enough to go to war, but not good enough to go to court, and all they needed was good enough to go to war. A couple years ago, a man named Ed Haas, who has a website called the Muckraker Report, learned that if you go on the FBI website and look under Osama bin Laden, spell it with a U, Osama, you find that he's listed for several terrorist attacks, but not for 9/11. Very puzzled, he called up Rex Toom, the head of investigative publicity for the FBI, and said, why? And Toom said, because the FBI has no hard evidence that bin Laden was responsible for 9/11. Claire Brown of INN heard that, was intrigued, called up Toom and said, did you really say that? And Toom said, that's exactly what I told Mr. Haas. Point number one. Number two, the whole story of these hijackers was, of course, they were devout Muslims, and so it was no problem for them to lose their lives on 9/11 because they were anxious to go to heaven. And we even have this document purportedly written by Muhammad Atta said he was very anxious to go to heaven, to be a martyr and go to heaven. What were these guys like in their daily lives? Did they spend a lot of time on the prayer rug and so on? No, they spent their time drinking, taking cocaine, going to strip clubs, and they seemed particularly fond of lap dancers. Muhammad Atta lived for a couple months early in 2001 with a stripper in Venice, Florida, where he was taking flight lessons. And this was well known, certainly by the people right next door who ran the apartment complex and rented the room to them. And it was in the local press. And yet if you read the FBI report about Muhammad Atta, you'll find that he left Venice, and if you know Florida, that's on the western side of Florida, and went over to Miami on the eastern side, and never came back to the west at the end of 2000. And yet, everybody in Venice knows that Muhammad Atta was living with Amanda Keller February to April. So, this idea that they were devout Muslims is put in question. There's a famous story about them drinking on September 7th at Shuckham's Bar in Miami, in Hollywood, which is part of Miami. This story went around the world. If you look back at your newspapers, you'll see the stories about them drinking, Muhammad Atta drinking orange juice and vodka, and his buddy drinking rum and coke. And the bartender said they were wasted. And pretty soon, however, this story started to change. And pretty soon it came that Atta really wasn't drinking vodka. He was just playing a video game. And then somebody figured out, well, he had to be drinking something. So in the LA Times, we learned actually he was drinking cranberry juice. So they allowed the other guy to keep drinking, but Atta, I mean, he's the real symbol here. He had to be a devout Muslim. If you read in the 9/11 Commission report, they report that Atta had become a serious Muslim. They said even fanatically religious he had become. Third, we learned, didn't we, from all these cell phone calls from the flights that the flights had been taken over by hijackers who were described as Middle Eastern One of the people even said he had a Muslim look to it. And this was what really got the whole thing started. Otherwise, how would have you known there were hijackers on the plane unless people from the plane had called and said, these guys are taking over the plane, they've got knives, and Barbara Olson said they had box cutters, and they had red bandanas. Somebody didn't know it was only Shiites who wear the red bandanas, and Al-Qaeda, of course, is Sunni. But we have had people in our government who didn't know the difference between Sunni and Shia, and this might have something to do with that. But nevertheless, we got all these stories. And particularly Flight 93, one of your fellow Canadians, Key Dudney, who used to write for Scientific America, did these experiments. And he referred to Flight 93 as the cell phone flight. Am I right, Michelle? Bring Michelle. Was that your term or was that his?
What?
The cell phone flight for Flight 93. Okay, I didn't want to give him credit for one of you, because they both wrote on this. Somehow it's Canadians who have taken the lead on the cell phone story. So now another Canadian, Roland Morgan, has written a manuscript that I hope gets translated, published, called Voices. And so we had at least 13 calls from Flight 93 that were said to be cell phone calls. And many, many news stories. Most of them would say, well, we learned what was going on in the flight because of these cell phone calls. And they came from all four flights. You had passengers making cell phone calls from the third and fourth, second, third, and fourth flights, so 175, 77, and 93. And then a flight attendant making a cell phone call from flight 11. And this was in many ways the most important. This was Amy Sweeney. And she told about the hijackers killing people and all of this. And so that was the first word about this that we had. Now, there was this little problem that Michelle mentioned, which is that cell phones don't work very well in high altitudes. He learned that if you went up in a single-engine plane and got much over 6,000 feet, it's very unlikely. You might get it up to 8,000 feet, maybe 10, but nothing. And then it's a double-engine plane, you've got a little more insulation, about 2,000 feet lower. With an airliner, with all that insulation, most people report they go off at about 1,000 feet. And certainly wouldn't get much over 5,000, 6,000. Absolutely, as Michelle said, not over 10,000 feet. And yet these calls from Flight 93 were made when the plane was at 31,000 or even over 40,000 feet. So there was a lot of skepticism in the 9/11 truth community about this and saying, hey, these calls could not have happened. So when the FBI put out its report, you know about the Moussaoui trial in 2006. Zacharias Moussaoui was was called the 20th hijacker. And so he was the one guy they could convict for at least planning to participate in the 9/11 attacks. And the fact that he was schizophrenic didn't hinder the process. And that's the guy that he would have hired to participate in such a project, right? So at this trial, it's very interesting. You can go on the government website and read these reports that the FBI turned in. This is when they had to present something in a court of law where it tends to be frowned upon to tell lies. You can get sent to prison for quite a long time for lying in a court of law. And so what the FBI reports say? Flight 93. There were 37 phone calls, 35 from onboard phones, 2 from cell phones. And those two were made at 9:58, they said, when the plane was down to 5,000 feet. That's still a little high, but at least arguable. So they just backed off all of those famous phone calls that had been reported hundreds of times as cell phone calls. The FBI, well, no, they weren't. They were. So how do you explain that? Well, some of the people, why did they, you know, who said they were cell phone calls? Well, the FBI interviewed people, and they said, We were called on a cell phone. How do you know it was a cell phone? Well, they told us. My daughter or my wife said, I borrowed a cell phone from my neighbor, and I'm calling you on a cell phone. So some of them were told. Well, you could think memory is a funny thing, or maybe they misunderstood, or like that. But what about Dina Burnett, who said she received 4 phone calls from her husband, Tom Burnett? And she knew they were from Tom because she looked on her caller ID and there's Tom's cell phone number. So this couldn't be a mistake. It'd be very hard to misremember this. The FBI came that very day, interviewed her, and that's what she told the FBI. It's in the report. You can read the report. So how do you explain that Dina Burnett believes she got 3 or 4, there was a little confusion on the number, but 3 or 4, cell phone calls. And the FBI now says she didn't. So let's assume she really didn't. Why did she say? What would be the motive for saying? She went on national TV. This was a very well-known story in the United States. I don't know how well known it's up here, but this was on, you know, CBS Morning Show, all this. She even wrote a book in 2006 and said these words. I know it was Tom because I saw his cell phone number on my caller ID. Well, some of us have a theory that there is this technology now. So cell phone technology couldn't have done this, but there is a technology known as voice morphing, which has been around this new form of it since at least 1999. And also, there are devices now, you can order them on the internet, where you can not only fake the voice, and it's so good you can fake your lover, and you can fake the phone call, the phone number. One of them is called a phone faker. And so I think that's what happened. These people were called. They really believed. I have no idea, no reason to think Dina Burnett was either confused or lying. She was duped. And if one person was duped, are you going to believe the rest of the story? This is one of those cases where you only need one absolutely clear-cut case. Now, I mentioned Amy Sweeney. Her story was written up. There was an FBI affidavit. The guy went and interviewed Michael Woodward at the American desk. And the story was that Amy had called him on her cell phone. And that's what Michael Woodward told the FBI. So the FBI, Jim Lechner, wrote it up. Now, in 2004, when they reported to the public, they had found a tape somehow in the Dallas American office. They didn't realize they had. And on there it says that she called on an air phone. And how did they get a tape? Because Michael Woodward didn't take the call. So the new story was that he was receiving this call from Amy, and he was repeating word for word what Amy said to a woman in the office, Nancy Wyatt, who was on the phone to Dallas, and the guy down in Dallas was recording her call. So third hand, we got word for word what Amy Sweeney said, and she said, well, I got down behind the seat and I borrowed an airphone card. Now, what in the world is an airphone card? But she borrowed an airphone card from another flight attendant and called on the airphone. So it was back, this was a new revelation to me. So it was back in 2004 they changed the story. They changed it just in time to get the new story in the 9/11 Commission report. And I hadn't realized that because when the 9/11 Commission refers to Flight 93, they say the passengers and the crew began making air phone calls and cell phone calls. And so I thought that meant right then they started making cell phone calls. No, when you look at the document this was based on, the staff report, already in 2004 they said the only two calls were the one from C.C. Lyles and Edward Felt, both at 9:58, which were made on cell phones when the plane was low enough for that to be possible. So you see how when they get in trouble, they just change the story. Now, there are records. If you make a cell phone call, there are records. It can be proved you made the call. If you make an onboard phone call from, you know, this one of them is Verizon, the other is Claricom, there are records. So there should be no mystery about. You can't just say, oh, well, you know, it was a cell phone. No, no, it was an air phone. It should be based on evidence. Now, this FBI report cites no evidence whatsoever. You just look, open up the document, and you see cell phone call for these two. On the others, you see made from this place, but there's not a single document reported that you could send a FOIA report for and say, show me the document, tell me the evidence for this. Okay, so this raises some question. Were there really hijackers on the plane? The most famous call, of course, was the one from Barbara Olson to Ted Olson. Ted Olson was the Solicitor General for the Department of Justice. He was very, very important. He was the guy who argued in front of the Supreme Court that the Florida recount should be stopped. Because if it had gone on, Gore would have won. Think how different life would be. But he got the Supreme Court to stop the recount, and so Bush and Cheney became president and vice president, not necessarily in that order. So he's a very important guy. So he was appointed then Solicitor General for the Department of Justice. So he was the guy that argued for the Supreme Court that Cheney didn't have to reveal who came to this secret energy meeting that occurred shortly before the invasion of Iraq. So on the morning of 9/11, he reported that he had gotten a phone call from his wife, Barbara, who was on Flight 77, and that all the passengers and crew had been herded to the back of the plane, and the hijackers were armed with knives and box cutters. Now, to show you how important this flight is, you've all heard they had box cutters, right? That was the only call that reported box cutters. None of the other calls mentioned box cutters. It was only this. So this was the most important of all the calls. For establishing what was going on there. Now, it was a pretty strange story. Here you had about almost 70 people on the plane, counting the crew. Captain and co-captain also, she specifically said, were back there. The captain was a champion boxer. And there were some other pretty good-sized people on there. Can you imagine three rather small men? You got two up in the cabin flying the plane, presumably. Or let's say there was only one, just Hani Hanjour, and let's say we got four. So four rather small guys with knives and box cutters are holding off 67 people, one of them a champion boxer. So it's a pretty strange story anyway. But it gets worse. One problem was, what did she use, a cell phone or an air phone? And Ted said he didn't know, and he went back and forth. He would tell one story, the other story. Finally settled on air phone. Then, in 2006, somebody in Germany in the 9/11 Truth Movement went on the website and said, wrote to American and said, I see your Boeing 757, so that's what Flight 77 was, don't have air phones. Oh, is that true? What about on 9/11? How about the people call out? And the guy says, that's absolutely right. We don't. The 767s do, but not the 757. And so he said the people had to use their cell phones. So there we're back to the problem of high altitude cell phone calls. Then it gets worse.